1 Timothy chapter 5, we're going to pick up in verse 3 and read down to verse 8. We really are kind of picking up in the middle of a train of thought here, in a little in the middle of the bigger context of the passage, and we're going to stop in the middle. It's kind of a subunit here of a bigger section. But so verse 3 says, "Honor widows that are widows indeed. But if any widow have children or nephews, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite their parents, for that is good and acceptable before God. Now she that is a widow indeed and desolate trusteth in God and continueth in supplications and prayers night and day. But she that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth. And these things give in charge that they may be blameless. But if any provide not for his own, especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel." In the Gospels, the first four books of the New Testament, we are given several different accounts of Jesus rebuking the Pharisees. Now, we know that the Pharisees had devised their own system of traditions that they had placed beside the commands of God and had, in fact, elevated above the commandments of God. And these traditions, the Pharisees believed, made them righteous in the eyes of God. And in the Gospels, we read just a few specific examples of what those traditions were. They had hundreds of different individual aspects of it, but we see just a few examples. But one such tradition that the Pharisees were taught was that a man could refuse to provide for his parents. So if his parents had a need, he saw the need, he'd say, "No, I'm not going to provide for your need because I have dedicated this money to the temple." So he could refuse to provide for their need if he had already, or if he was going to, dedicate that money to go to the temple. In Matthew chapter 15, Jesus rebukes the Pharisees, and quite strongly, for this tradition, telling them that they were making God's commandments worthless. Now, the fifth of the Ten Commandments says, "Honor thy father and mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee." In Ephesians chapter 6, Paul is writing to the same group of believers that Timothy is ministering to. Paul refers to that fifth commandment, honor thy father and mother, as the first commandment with a promise attached to it. The first one with promise is how he says it. And what Paul is saying in this section of the letter to Timothy is very specific instructions regarding how the church is to respond to needy widows. It is now really, he is fleshing out an application of obedience to that command. And he's fleshing out even an application somewhat of what Christ is rebuking the Pharisees for in Matthew chapter 15. And in these instructions, Paul addresses the church's responsibility as a church and the individual Christian's responsibility as a believer. But I can sum up this entire section by saying that we have a basic Christian duty to provide for those that God has entrusted to our care. Really, all of chapter 5 and the first two verses of chapter 6 addresses the believers' relationships with one another. That's why I said this is a subsection in a larger section here. As we see the relationships of the elder and the younger, the men and the women, widows, pastors, congregations, and servants, they're all addressed in these 27 verses. And the underlying assumption in all of this is that we as Christians must behave towards one another in a godly fashion. And really, that's it. These 27 verses explain what godliness looks like in these specific instances and relationships. These verses provide for us principles to guide us in our other Christian relationships and in other situations. And so Paul begins this section with a very straightforward statement, honor widows that are widows indeed. That's where he begins this subunit, this subsection of this. And a widow indeed, just he defines it for us a little bit and describes it in verse 4 and defines it a little bit more in verse 5. But a widow indeed is a widow who is genuinely alone. She is one that has no family who will care for her. So whether it be through death or desertion, these widows were one that had no family who would provide for them. Now, I'm wording that carefully, and I want you to understand part of what he's saying. He's not just describing those who are widows and they have no family at all, because there were many in the church, or at least presumably there were many in the church who were widows, who were believers whose family had rejected them. So that they might have had kids, they might have had other or grandkids and our other relatives that could have taken care of them, but those other relatives, they said, no, we're not. You are a believer, in essence, the unsaved family is saying you've left us and rejected us, we're going to reject you and we're not going to take care of you. That's the part of the idea here. It's a widow who is without anybody who will help her. She has no family who will care for her. And the church's obligation is very straightforward. I mean, it's really one of these unmistakable, clear instructions here. We are to honor just such a ones, we are to honor them. Now, talk about the word honor. And this is an important word for you to remember as we're working through the rest of this epistle, but other epistles. The word honor is used in two different, though similar, ways. Sometimes it's used in how we would normally use it, in meaning giving someone the proper respect that is due to them. And that's typically how we would describe honor. It's giving them a right respect or is upholding them in respect. It's also used, and it's used several times in the epistles in another way, and that is to repay them according to their proper value. So honor can have an attitude or it can have a dollar sign. Most often, and particularly in the pastoral epistles, 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, it uses both meanings. So it combines them together really to show someone respect and worth through financial remuneration, so that by really with our finances, with our money, we are showing that person the respect that is due to them. That's kind of the idea of what is being said, and it's really the context determines exactly how it's being used. But Paul is using, and I think we can see it very clearly in this context, Paul is using this word honor in that last sense, showing them their worth and respect to them by providing for their physical needs. And so Paul says honor, really, physically provide for widows that are genuinely desolate. Provide for widows who have nobody that is providing for them. And again, he describes them. Verse 5, he says, "Now she that is a widow indeed and desolate trusteth in God and continueth in supplications and prayers night and day." And before that, it says in verse 4, it says, "If she have children or nephews, let them first learn to show piety at home and to requite," or literally, repay their parents. "For that is good and acceptable to God." So this widow, that is a widow indeed, is somebody that does not have a child, or I think we would be more correct in saying grandchild. If you care about the Greek, you can ask me later. I won't get into it. But the word is probably not best rendered nephew, as we think of it, because we think of, you know, nephew, that's my brother's son. Or something to that effect. I think more properly it's grandchildren. So a widow indeed is somebody that doesn't have children or grandchildren that will care to them, but instead she is desolate, that is without anyone to help, and she trusts in God, so that she is devoted to God, that she is dependent on God, that she is not living her life however she would like, as he refers to in verse 6, living in pleasure. But that she is trusting in God, she is depending fully on God, and that she is continuing in prayers, that she is a godly woman. She is evidently trusting God, and she is living in godliness. She is living, and I think particularly in the context, I think we can make a strong argument to say that she is actively engaged in the ministry of prayers for that local church. I think there's a particular service ministry that he is addressing. We're going to look at that next week there. But that she is a godly woman who is trusting in God. And Paul places the priority of caring for them and the obligation of caring for these widows on the church. Let me pause for just a second. We'll come back to the text here in just a moment. There is a clear expectation in scriptures, in the New Testament, for the church to be discerning about how it distributes benevolence. I'm back away from the passage and just take a kind of a broader principle for a second. Galatians 6, verse 10 says to do good to all men, especially those that are of the household of faith. That verse places the priority of our good works as to being done towards those in the church. This passage that we're looking at here indicates that there are some to whom we would limit our charitable giving or to whom the church does not have an obligation to give. So really, we can say legitimately from scriptures, the church has no duty to give to everyone who asks, or to everyone who is in need. Now, I know that kind of flies in the face of some of our charitable notions with churches, but really we have no biblical duty to provide for everyone in need or everyone who asks of us. Instead, we have several instructions to practice discernment in how we are distributing benevolence and how we are ministering to those who have needs. And so the church, really, it's not biblically obligated to give all that it possibly can give benevolently. The church's duty, first and foremost, is to meet the needs of the genuinely needy in the congregation who are living godly lives. So you talk about a benevolent ministry, the priority of the church's benevolent ministry should be internal, not that we don't care about the outside. That's not what I'm implying here. But the priority is internal, and even in that, there is discernment exercised in the testimony of the person that we are ministering to. So there's somebody that is living in sin. The church has every legitimate right, and I would say to an extent a duty to say, no, we're not going to continue to provide, or we are not going to provide in this situation. That there is and yet on the other side of the coin, there is an absolute duty, which is what he's talking about here, those that are in real need, that are living godly lives, now the church must, not can, must provide for them. So there's several things that are implied in this, but the very clear instruction is we are to meet the needs of those who are living godly lives who are in real desperate need. And we see this. I mean, Paul's talking about the widows. We see this really in the very beginning. The church was active in caring for the needs of its members. And some of this was necessary. It was a necessary response due to persecution, which left many Christians rejected by their families, and they were refused. They were not allowed to have any work in the community. And these believers were legitimately destitute. Some of them were fleeing from one city to another with nothing. They were coming to a new city and into a new body of believers, and they had nothing. There was a legitimate and very necessary ministry to them. And we see that continuing, and particularly in Acts chapter 6, we find there was an organized distribution to the needy widows, and that was kind of the prelude to the appointment of deacons to the church. And so, really, we can say, right off the bat from this passage, benevolent care for the needy in the congregation is the normal Christian response. And particularly, The Christian response is to provide for those who have no ability to provide for themselves. It should be our natural, it should be a normal, should really be an automatic response. If we are believers and we see another believer that has a need and has no ability to meet that need, that we are saying, let me help. Let me meet that need. We as a church and we as individual Christians are saying, let us help. James 1 verse 27 says, pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this. So genuine, holy religion. That's what he's defining. Godly religion, holiness that is pure before God. This is what it looks like. To visit or to minister to the fatherless and the widows in their affliction. So James, he's intending to describe it, to define what godly religion looks like. He sums it all up and he says, pure religion, true religion, holy, is to visit orphans and widows, to minister to them in their time of need. And so as we think on this passage, there must be a priority in our lives, in our relationships, of ministering to the needs of those who need, I mean, who have really no means of providing for themselves. We're not to be stingy towards those in need. We're to be generous. We're to be ready and quick to give aid. Now, not absent discernment, but within discernment, we are to be quick to give aid. We're to be generous with that. We are not to, in the least bit, be stingy in providing for those that have need. And so he says, honor widows that are widows indeed. As a church, meet the needs, particularly of those that have, those older ladies that have no family to care for them, provide for their needs. But this provision for the needs of others is not to relieve others of their obligations. And you see, verse 4 particularly, there is not a suggestion here that the church should provide for those who can provide for themselves or for their own family. Paul not only instructs the church to provide for those in need, he instructs sons and grandsons to provide for their older family members. And let me, again, pause for a second and mention something else clearly taught in the passage, and I'm going to come back to it in a few minutes as well. But the obligation on providing for the household is placed on the men. That's a really popular, politically correct statement. The obligation for providing for the household is placed on the men. This is not a prohibition against women working or bringing in income. That's not what this is. But it does place the obligation for familial provision squarely on the men. And so the word that's translated there, verse 4, children, really must be translated sons. It's not referring to all children. It's referring to the sons. So those widows who have family are to be supported by their family. And that's really the point. He's not saying, okay, all those widows, you go run to the church and let the church take care of you. He's saying those widows that have family that can take care of them, be taken care of by the family. So that those widows who do not have family to take care of them, they can be provided for by the church. But he is placing an obligation on those who, frankly, have that obligation. He's placing the burden on those in the family to care for them. And what Paul says in verse 4, if any widow have children or nephews, let them first learn to show piety at home. He is saying this proper provision for family members, in this context, the proper provision for older family members, is the practice of godliness. That word piety means proper reverence to God. And so men, just very simply, we show proper reverence to God at home by providing for the needs of our families. We show proper reverence. As believers, we show proper reverence to God at home by providing for the needs of our older family members. And we need to start from a biblical principle that says, I have, as a child or grandchild, I have an obligation to minister to my older parent or grandparent who has need, and I am the first line of responsibility. I'm not the last line of responsibility after all of the other systems had fallen. I am the first line of responsibility to minister to their needs. And then when it is beyond my ability and I am unable to minister to their need or unable to continue, then we go to the other systems. But the biblical principle begins with the personal obligation to provide for parents and grandparents, to provide for family, particularly in the context for those who are widowed. And so as we're thinking about this, again, Paul says, let them first learn to show piety at home. This is a matter of our godliness. This is an expression of our right relationship and reverence to God. Now, this is not just a kind of an optional social thing that we can do if we feel like it. This is an expression of our relationship with God. And he goes on, and Paul puts really the burden of this, and he says to repay their parents. We have the King James word requite, and it's what it means. It's repay. Those of you that raise kids, you know how much it costs. And there is absolutely, that's exactly what Paul is pointing to. There has been a huge investment in you as a child, and the proper response of godliness is to return that investment back when they are not able to provide for themselves. It is that there comes a point in time, at least for many households, there comes a point in time where the roles are somewhat, not completely, but somewhat reversed, so that the provider becomes the provided for. And that is really the natural response. And look, this is so utterly basic to just the general human understanding of our family responsibilities. Thousands of years ago, the Greeks made it a law. They bound children legally and morally to support their parents. So that in the Greek society, anyone who refused to support his parents lost his civil rights. So that, to put maybe a modern spin on it, if you were an American and this was a law, if you refused to take care of your parents, you would no longer be an American citizen. You would lose all the rights of being an American. It would no longer apply to you. That is the extent to which the Greeks understood this responsibility. And we, of course, we don't base our conduct off social, whether it be ancient or modern, we don't base our conduct off social expectations. We base our conduct off the commands of God, and God says we're to provide for our families. To do so is honorable. So he says there, it is good, it is praiseworthy. It is that which is acceptable, it is that which is beautiful, it is that which is notable, it is that which is worthy of genuine praise, and it is pleasing to God. The word acceptable, it is that which pleases Him, so that when we do provide for the needs of our families, when we do provide for the needs of parents and grandparents, it is that which is praiseworthy to God. It is praiseworthy of men. And it is that which pleases God. And God looks and says, I like that. I mean, that's really what it gets down to. God approves of it. Says, this is a good thing. This is what you should be doing. And continuing on through this passage, Paul tells Timothy in verse 7 to give these things as commands to the church. He says, for these things, give in charge. Now, again, this is not optional. These are commands commanded by God for us to obey. And when we obey this command, it sets us apart from blame. And look, as I've already alluded to, the culture of that day placed a high priority on caring for aged parents. For a believer to neglect his family was to bring on himself the reproach of his neighbors. It would have been immediate. It would have been notable. It would have been unmistakable. The neighbors would have said, how can you do that? And there absolutely would have been a point of, you claim to be a Christian, and yet you treat your parents like that. And Paul says, command these things. He tells Timothy, command these things to the church, so the church will be blameless. And so the command to us as a church is, do these things, so that we will be blameless. And it really, again, just as a general principle, it should never be said that the unsaved world is more careful about Christian duties than the believer. In this instance, the neglect of the family was and is a shameful act that should be censured by all men. And we need to, as believers, need to be understanding what our Christian duties are, and we need to be in the forefront of performing them. We need to be the first ones. The world should never be able to look and say, that's a basic obligation of a believer, and you're not doing it. We must be without blame in these matters. But again, in the context here, Paul is saying providing for families, for older family members. In verse 8, Paul broadens it out a little bit, and he applies this principle to his man providing for his own household. So he says in verse 8, but if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, those that are under his roof, that's the idea, those that are in his household, those that are under his roof and under his care. So now Paul's taking this principle and he's applying it to a man and taking care of all of those that are entrusted into his care. And throughout verse 8, the terminology here is decidedly in the masculine. So that as we come to this verse, the obligation is definitively on the man to provide for his household. And this is not a new obligation. It is there from the very beginning, from creation. As we see, it was to Adam primarily that the responsibility was given to care for the garden. We see to Adam was given in the curse that his work now of providing is going to become a drudgery. There's not an expectation that he's not going to work. There's not a new command to go work. Now there is a curse of the work, that this work he has to do to provide for the family is now going to become a difficult drudgery. It's going to be a miserable job many times. Even the earth itself is going to fight against him. And frankly, the idea of the woman being the major provider for the family is unknown in the Bible. It is practically unknown in history up until very recent days. Again, it doesn't mean that women have no right to work outside the home. That's not the point of this message at all. Proverbs 31 argues against that. It does mean that every husband and father has a biblical obligation to bear the primary responsibility of making sure the family's needs are met. Man, look at how strongly this is stated. It says there, if you do not provide for your household, you are denying the faith. That is how strongly this is worded. And as I've said throughout this study, our behavior absolutely impacts our doctrine. So the faith you say you hold to, the faith that you have said you believed, the faith that you are supposed to be teaching to your family, is either being upheld and supported by your provision for that family, or it is being undermined and denied by your laziness. Now, I know our culture has elevated the status of the working mom and the stay-at-home dad. As Christians, again, we don't have the option of following society's ideals or imaginations or whatever they may call them. We must follow by the commands of the God, even if it's scorned by the world. And I know this kind of statement that the husband is the primary provider and he's supposed to be is absolutely hated. I know it brings much scorn within the world, and sadly it brings scorn even within the church at times, but that is the biblical truths that are communicated from this passage and from others as well. And so we must obey the commands of God. Now, let me put a caveat in here very quickly. I'm fully aware there are valid reasons for the husband not being the primary provider. Physical disability is first one that comes to my mind. There are absolutely legitimate times where the husband is not able to. This is not addressing those who are unable to provide. It is addressing those who are unwilling to provide. And that's a big distinction. And it's a very necessary distinction. I want to read everything, listen to everything I just said with that distinction in mind. So you can play it back in your mind later with that qualification. There is a huge difference between being unable and being unwilling. It's addressing those who refuse to do so or who concoct some excuse to justify their refusal. So if you're unable, do not be discouraged by the passage. Please don't. It's not intended for that. If you're being lazy, be convicted, because it is intended for that. Be changed, because that's the point. And what he says here is our provision, the way we deal, the way we care for our family, speaks volumes to our faith. It speaks volumes about what we really believe. So much so, I think we can legitimately say from this passage, if you say, I am a believer, I love God, I love the church, I'm growing in the Lord, and you got this whole long list, and yet you say, but I do not, and I will not, go find a job and provide for my family, I can say confidently with Paul, you are denying everything you just said. All that you just said, you've just rendered untrue by your refusal to meet a very basic familial obligation. Because it is your obedience to these basic commands that reveals the true state of your relationship with God. Now, again, I'll throw this caveat in as well, does not make you righteous by providing for your family. If you've got a really good job and a big income and you're providing all kinds of things for your family, you're not automatically godly. It does not make you godly. If you are working and working hard and just barely making ends meet, or maybe not quite making ends meet, it does not make you less godly. This is not a measurement. This does not make you or you godly in keeping this, but it absolutely reflects the true state of your godliness. It absolutely reflects the reality of your relationship with God and the reality of your faith. And in fact, he says that he that refuses to provide for his family is worse than an infidel. I mean, if the pagans around in that culture are saying, if you don't provide for your family, you can't be a citizen of our nations, how in the world can a Christian say, I'm not going to take care of my family? I'm going to neglect that obligation. That's what Paul's saying. Even the unsaved, the pagans all around have got this figured out. And you say you don't have to do it? I mean, it doesn't make sense. I mean, you're not even doing the basic things that the lost think they need to be doing. I mean, even in today's warped social systems, there's still an overarching assumption that you provide for your needs of your family. We still toss around the phrase deadbeat dads. We still talk of neglect. And it's a shame if a Christian ever refuses to do that, which even the unsaved recognize as a basic human responsibility. And that's what Paul means. He says we are, even the lost know to take care of their families. How much more should Christians? We must be providing. And so let me conclude. If I can, again, step back from the passage for just a moment and just give a simple overarching application every one of you can take home. Whether you be a mom or a dad, a grandparent or child, one thing is abundantly plain from this passage. Your Christianity must inform and impact your relationships. Your faith must be, and it will be, visible in your interactions with your parents, your grandparents, and your children. If you claim to be a believer, then that should be evident in the way you treat your family. Now, probably many of you have heard the saying, godliness begins at home. Unfortunately, for many, godliness ends at home. Many believers become skilled at putting on the godly habits when they're out and about, and they revert to their natural selfishness when they get home. Really, this must not be. The place where you should strive the hardest to be godly should be in your home. So when the back door closes behind you after a busy day, that is when your faith really needs to be fleshed out. And you know, it seems like the assumption is, you know, they're stuck with me. they're my wife, my husband, my kids, they're kind of stuck. So I'm going to go home and I can be normal around them. I don't have to do all these other things. You know, what Paul is saying, what should be true of our life, is godliness should be the normal. So when we go home and we want to just kind of prop our feet up spiritually and take our coat off and just sit back and relax and think, okay, I'm done with the spiritual exertions for the day. Quit bugging me. Go away and leave me alone and let me live how I want to live. That is when we need to be putting on the godliness. That is when we say, okay, I'm going home to these people that I'm going to have the most influence on. These are the ones that I am in the closest relationship with. These are the ones that I need to really make sure I'm putting on the godliness. These are the ones that really need to see this fleshed out in my life. So to say this in a different way, if you claim to be a godly Christian, but you don't live like it at home, you're not a godly Christian. Your public reputation does not make you godly. The private realities of your life is what shows your godliness. I'll say it again in a different way. Your faith will be evident by your works. So the genuineness of your faith will be shown by your works. Your works at home will reveal the reality of your faith. Not the work that you might do for others' notice, but the works that are done for no one's notice. Those things reveal your faith. So that genuine faith works. It puts itself into practice. It applies itself in all situations. And so the question for us, as we're thinking about this, and just to take home one application, is what does your home life reveal about your faith? What does your family reveal about your faith?